A very self-assured Barry Williamson shows no apprehension as he sits down amid a corps of reporters to talk about one of the most controversial subjects in Alaska. Bristol Bay? That's in the hands of Congress. An oil man in charge of leasing? No apologies. He can be as environmentally inclined as his boss.
We're taking a new approach, and this president is serious when he talks about being the environmental president. If you don't believe him, you're out of step with what he's doing. And many people are learning that, both sides of the issue.
He also defends Interior Secretary Manuel Lujan's decision to let Shell Western drill in the Chukchi Sea this summer, despite a request by Governor Cooper to hold off.
We were asked by Governor Cooper to review the oil spill contingency plans in light of the Valdez, and we did exactly that. We worked very closely with his staff, and worked very closely with Shell. Shell Western Exploration Production did an excellent job in communicating and coordinating with the governor's office, with the state of Alaska, and with our office. We found their contingency plan to be adequate, the equipment to be the best we've ever seen, the best oil spill contingency plan we've ever had.
The project involves four vessels, he said, including a barge and skimmers equipped to boom off a spill and suck it up at the rate of 1,600 to 1,800 gallons a minute. And in the future, the next Chukchi sail will leave out whale migration paths along the coast.
I work with Al Powers, our regional director here in Alaska. He recommended that we defer it, and I agreed with him that we deferred it, because we're concerned about that issue.
In response to direct questions about whether the Exxon Valdez disaster is affecting the way his office does business, Williamson answers yes. There's more public concern, and his office knows it has to assure the public that drilling will be regulated to make it safe. Congress is slapping moratoria on leasing plans, and that is a political reality.
The moratoria issues were heating up each year. Did the Exxon Valdez fan the flame? Yes. But these issues were coming to the head. The issue is, do we need to drill offshore? And can we do it in an environmentally sound manner? Well, number one, yes, we do need to drill offshore. That's the position of this administration. We'll only do it if we can do it in an environmentally sound manner. That's the question that we have to answer on a case-by-case basis.
But Williamson also points out that the Exxon Valdez spill was a transportation accident, not a drilling disaster. By his reasoning, that's an argument for offshore development as less risky than imports.
Every barrel of oil that you don't produce domestically and on the outer continental shelf is one more barrel you have to run in by foreign tanker and run the risk of a tanker spill. Those are the facts.
Barry Williamson, the new director of the Minerals Management Service. For APRN, I'm Steve Heimel.
What we've learned is the cost of cleanup and removal is staggering. So this raises the liability limits to $1 billion, and this would pay for the situation where the party carrying the oil was unable to pay the complete cost. This is sort of an insurance fund, if you will, nationally.
Senator Stevens pointed out that in the case of the Exxon Valdez spill, the company had enough money to pay the costs. But there continues to be confusion about who is actually in charge of deciding how that money is spent. Senate Bill 686 would change that. It would charge both domestic and foreign oil-producing companies 1.3 cents per barrel, building up a fund of $1 billion. Alaska producers would get credit for money already paid into the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Liability Fund. If an oil spill should happen anywhere in the U.S. on land or sea, $250,000 of the fund would be immediately available to the governor of the affected state to begin cleanup work. Local, state, and federal response agencies would also be able to draw from the fund immediately after a spill.
For the transportation of things like skimmers, for the transportation of boom, we won't have to wait as we had to wait. A lot of people, as you know, down in Prince William Sound put up their own money to protect those hatcheries. That won't happen again. This money is there. The instant response team will be there. The on-site commander is there. This does federalize, in effect, the control of major spills throughout the United States, and it puts someone in charge. Ultimately, it's the president, but he will delegate that.
Stevens says the bill also provides for surprise drills to make certain companies transporting oil don't get comfortable with success.
The complacency that developed over year after year after year of successful transit of the Prince William Sound led to the dissolution of the response teams that were there and to the rusting of the barge. And That boom that was there was boom that had been ordered years before, had been weathered, been through the worst winter in history just before it was deployed. It was brittle, it broke. I personally talked to one of the people who was hired to put it out, and every time they got it hooked up, it just broke.
The Senate version of the bill would require at least 2 surprise drills a year, with both personnel and equipment always available to deal with the loss of their entire cargo. When Congress returns from its August recess, a Senate House Conference Committee will work out differences in their bills. Stevens is a part of that committee, and he expects a final version to be through the process and on to President Bush by the end of October. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
I figured like till the middle of September even would have been good. 2 more weeks. What's 2 more weeks?
The Port Lions Beach crew is working on a Fognak Island where a Fognak village used to be. The 1964 earthquake and tidal wave destroyed the old village, so the inhabitants moved to Kodiak Island and established the village of Port Lions. Port Lions residents come back to a Fognak regularly to picnic, to pick berries, to show the kids where their relatives were born. You can still see dilapidated houses and the old Russian Orthodox church standing along the shore. Today, there's no picnics or berry picking. The crew is bent over, picking up oil, digging under boulders, and wiping off rocks.
It's so bruised on there, you can't wipe it off.
It's like an oil stain.
It's burnt, sunburnt, on. See, it was like this. See, watch. You could wipe this off, see? But you can't wipe that off because that's sunburnt on there.
Something.
And it's underneath the boulders.
See, we cleared all this. I see where all that clear sand and all that is, huh?
Mm-hmm.
We cleared all that oil off it.
And it doesn't even look clean now, does it?
Mm-mm. But we're thinking we're doing a beautiful job. Tell the truth, huh, Deb?
Yeah.
We think we're doing great.
It's a small crew, only 5 people. They started out with 22. A number of people quit because they refused to submit to a drug test. Exxon never replaced the ones who left. Debbie Von Scheele says the crew may be small, but they put out a big effort.
Yeah. Well, we believe
that
in
one
cleaning
day,
it is a
there
problem.
Was 4 of us. Our teams were split, and there was only 4 of us working on that beach right over there. Just a little area. 4 women, not men, 4 women, did 400 bags.
Eileen Griggs says it's sad to see the old village site littered with oil. Griggs has been working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, since June, but she'd be willing to keep at it through September. She's proud of being part of the cleanup effort.
You have to dig under the sand again to get the tarp up.
You really have a lot of village.
It's just been an awful busy summer. Quite a different summer. Doing this, but I'm really happy that I did it and stuck through the whole ordeal of it.
Why is that?
Because I feel like I accomplished a lot. Who'd ever think we'd be coming here to do this? Oh yeah, we were at Hazelwood quite a bit this summer. Quite a bit.
In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
I think the experience of the Exxon Valdez shows someone must be in charge from the first moment. The best thing I've seen so far is the reaction of that young Coast Guard officer in Rhode Island. Theoretically, the same thing applied to that tanker, but it was a foreign tanker, and he gave them 30 minutes to demonstrate they could control the oil. If they couldn't, he was going to federalize it, and he did federalize it. The impact of it is that the response will be immediate. We'll argue later who pays. And we will not have to go have approval of the party at fault before we can have expenditures of money by the federal, or state, or local governments. This bill provides that the costs of prevention are paid throughout the years. In other words, these response teams, the cost of organizing, the cost of maintaining some of these regional supply centers for boom, for skimmers, for all the rest, that will be paid ultimately from this fund.
Well, down in that area, we're real touched and appreciative when I did make the call. Down there, they were just real impressed that people from this far away were concerned of what was going on and, you know, the disastrous impact that oil spill had on. We figured we'd have a healthy run coming up the River of Silvers now, so that we thought it'd be a good gesture to do something. He said he'd be frustrated wanting to do something to help out in the oil spill, and this is something that we can do.
The borough is considering subsidizing a small-scale cleanup program of its own. Borough Mayor Jerome Selby says local officials hope to fund the program with money from the state's Community Grant Assistance Program.
Kind of a stitch in time to cover the winter, assuming that Exxon and the Coast Guard are coming back next summer to address big problems. But if there are smaller problems, we're trying to put together a program that would be in place this fall and winter. We're continuing to work on that. If folks have good ideas or recommendations, we're certainly amenable to hear those. This will not be a big dollars effort. The state doesn't have a lot of money.
One idea is to establish a bounty program where anyone could collect oily waste and get paid by the bag for their efforts. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
As some 140 lawsuits piled up in Anchorage Superior Court over the oil spill, Exxon waited for the state to weigh in with its own major claim. Tuesday morning, the Attorney General did just that, naming Exxon, Alyeska Pipeline, and all seven owners of the consortium in a suit that officials say could reach into the billions of dollars. Besides Exxon and Alyeska, that means the pipeline companies of ARCO, BP, Amerada Hess, Mobil, Phillips, and Unocal are defendants in this case. At a news conference Tuesday morning, State Oil Spill Coordinator Robert Laresh said the liability extends to all the major owners of the pipeline because they made the decision to cut back on the manpower, training, and equipment at Alyeska's marine terminal that the state says led directly to the failure to contain the spill. Laresh called Alyeska a sham and a corporate shell that the owner companies had been hiding behind.
These people, these companies, the complaint maintains, had such control over Alyeska's operations, day-to-day operations, budgets, and performance, that they, ARCO, BP, Phillips, and all the others, were responsible for Alyeska's failure to respond properly to this spill.
Exxon attorney Richard Clinton says he's not surprised by the suit, although Exxon wasn't aware the state planned to file it this week. Clinton says he was a little surprised to see all the individual pipeline owners named as defendants.
Well, I guess a few of the other cases have done that, so I was somewhat surprised, but it wasn't a complete surprise.
The lawsuit seeks common law remedies and punitive damages, as well as relief based on a host of state statutes, including negligence in spilling the oil, negligence in not cleaning it up properly, lying about the industry's ability to deal with a big spill, employing unsafe vessels, that is, tankers with only single hulls, in an inherently dangerous trade, breach of the pipeline right-of-way lease, public nuisance, private nuisance, and trespass. Among other things, the state charges that Exxon systematically reduced the crew size of tankers in the Valdez trade for the purpose of saving money, leaving a crew on the Exxon Valdez that the state says was overworked, fatigued, and not alert on the evening of March 23rd. The complaint says for a variety of reasons, the defendants either intentionally or negligently permitted Captain Hazelwood and the crew of the Exxon Valdez to frequently and systematically violate Coast Guard regulations and Exxon policies concerning the manning and operation of the tanker. The state claims two incidents caused the spill, the grounding on Bly Reef and later attempts to dislodge the vessel. Then, according to the complaint, Alyeska failed to respond to the spill immediately and then handed over control of the response to Exxon, causing, quote, delay, confusion, and ineffective use of equipment and manpower. As a result, the state says more than 1,000 square miles of Alaska land and water suffered severe environmental damage. Other damages include lost fish and wildlife, loss of business associated with those resources, cost to the state, and loss of oil revenue, and, quote, the infliction of emotional distress on Alaskans. All these damages are unspecified for now to be proven at trial. Laresh says the total will likely reach into the multiple billions of dollars. Attorney General Bailey doesn't want to attach any figures to the suit at this point. And as for how long all this is going to take, Bailey isn't expecting a trial date anytime soon.
I would expect a minimum of 5 to 6 years.
Any guesses on how long it would take to end the trial?
No, that would be speculation along the lines of the dollar amount of the state's ultimate claim.
Attorney General Douglas Bailey. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
It's rare for Midge Garber to receive visitors, but there's been a lot more drop-in traffic lately. This time, the chopper brings a DEC shoreline survey crew.
Everything, so.
You haven't seen a fair amount of birds.
Every day.
Okay.
Every day.
Garber says she and her husband chose to live on Tagetik because they were tired of seeing man's inhumanity to man. This summer, they've had to see man's inhumanity to the environment. And for Midge, it's been heartbreaking.
You know, it's just a pathetic, you know, just I picked those little oil-covered birds up, you know, because we're animal lovers, nature lovers, you know, that's why we're out here, you know, because of the birds and the seal. We're just out here all by ourselves, and we love it. This impact I feel because Tagetik is it's a newer island, you know, there's no trees or anything. And the echo balance out here is extremely delicate.
Tagetik is where 9 gray whales washed up in recent months. Garber has seen the carcasses firsthand, and she suspects oil caused at least some of the deaths.
The inside of the baleen is just a black, you know. When you see these animals all the time, you know what kills them, you know. I'm not a marine biologist, but I know my own animals very well.
The Garbers have been working 18 to 20-hour days picking up bird carcasses and oil moose off the beach. They've been asking authorities to send a cleanup crew to Tagetik since the oil first hit in May.
There hasn't been anyone out to clean up one a damn thing. All these observation teams, there are two in the area right now. All they do is ride around and look. And not one person, except my husband and I, have cleaned up one thing.
Garber admits working the beach on Tagetik could be hazardous. There's patches of quicksand, and one could easily get trapped between an incoming tide and the perpendicular cliffs. But John Garber, her husband, offered to guide any crew assigned, and Midge offered to put the workers up and cook for them. But throughout the summer, officials rated Tagetik as having only a light impact. It was considered a low priority.
I guess they feel there's, you know, just a tool sourdoughs out here, and it's just a, you know, one a small little island. So it's only 71 square miles, you know, but it's a very important island, in, with the fact of, that it's a bird haven, you know, and there's so many endangered species, animals, and birds out here, you know. It's important to me.
For a while, two fish and game vessels were assigned to the area, but they were forbidden to pick up oil. They were just supposed to bag birds. Later, when the vessels were reassigned, the Garbers could get no one to pick up the waste that was piling up.
With bags and bags of moose and dead birds, finally, it's either burn it or have the rest of what's remaining of our birds eat the dead carrion then they get sick and die.
But now it looks like the bags of carcasses will be picked up, and the Garbers will get some help on the beach cleaning. Exxon representative John Peavy announced a 6-person crew would be sent to the island immediately. The crew will only be stationed there for a few days. Meanwhile, Exxon plans to meet with DEC and Fish and Wildlife representatives to discuss whether further action is necessary. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Exxon was told that wide-scale use of Corexit 9580 was not approved and that all use of the chemical cleaner must stop at once, despite Exxon protests.
Not only is Exxon very disappointed with that decision, we very strongly disagree with the decision.
Exxon's Bill Rainey argued at last night's operations briefing for another review of the data, but was turned down. Federal on-scene coordinator, Coast Guard Rear Admiral David Cangolini, says a proposal for a very small-scale test would be considered, but it's up to Exxon to decide whether it wants to pursue more testing.
Until data is made available that clarifies at least the problems that the committee and I have concerning the use of Corexit, I feel that we cannot use it any further.
Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Kodiak Island is directly downstream from the Barrens, and residents are worried about effects of bioremediation on their waters. DEC's Arnie Shryock says bioremediation has a number of good points, but it has some drawbacks. It can't be used anywhere there's pooled oil, and it doesn't work on moose. It works best on lightly to moderately oiled sediments. Shryock says bioremediation elements are also toxic if they come in contact with workers' skin.
However, the dilution factor in the ocean is such that it'll have no practical effect if it's done properly.
Shryock says bioremediation treatments have been approved conceptually for many locations. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
The Sequel was a 67-foot steel-hulled bay shrimper serving as a fish tender for North Pacific Processors of Cordova. The Sequel capsized and sank Tuesday morning about 4 miles northwest of Naked Island, according to Coast Guard Chief Ed Morath.
The vessel Discovery saw the Sequel capsize and went right to the scene, picked up one survivor who was in a life raft.
Morath says Coast Guard helicopters and vessels searched the area for the three missing people, but the search had been called off for the day by dark with no success. No names have been released. Information from the Coast Guard is not available yet as to whether the Sequel was loaded with fish or not when it sank, but there had been a 12-hour opening the day before in areas not too far away. One unofficial source says there were 100,000 pounds of fish aboard when the Sequel went down. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The Vicoda Bay site was chosen because it's close to oil cleanup areas, it doesn't conflict with an existing fishery, and it's far away from people. But residents of Port Lyons feel the barge is too close for comfort. Vicoda Bay is about 8 miles away from their village. They're concerned about the effect emissions might have on health, and they're angered that people from Port Lyons had no input about the barge's location. Exxon has promised to hear their concerns before burning. But time's running out. Exxon says there are no plans to continue burning after September 15th, and since Exxon feels Vicoda Bay is a suitable place to burn oily waste, it should begin any day.
Exxon pushed for wide-scale use of its chemical cleaner to test operational procedures. The state approved of the proposal and scrambled to arrange tests that would measure effectiveness. The end result was that agencies involved decided Exxon had not proved that Corexit 9580 was any more effective than any other treatment now in use. At Tuesday night's operations briefing, Exxon's Bill Rainey said not only was Exxon disappointed with the decision, Exxon disagreed with it, and Rainey proceeded to argue for further review of the data.
We strongly disagree with the statements that have been made on the efficiency evaluation. I understand the basis for the statements. The basis of the statements on efficiency were on gallons of oil recovered, and gallons of oil recovered over a period of time for the Corexit sites versus the hot water clean sites. However, there was no measurement of the amount of oil that was perceived to be on each of the sites in the first place.
Rainey said it was significant that Corexit cleaned twice as many square feet per hour as hot water washing, and that should be used as a strong measure of effectiveness. But NOAA's Sharon Christofferson, who chairs the Research and Development Committee, explained that the recommendation against Corexit was based on not being able to document an increase in efficiency of removing the oil from the environment, rather than the efficiency of removing the oil from the beach.
Most of us that have seen the various pocket, what we call postage stamp tests, and also the other field tests, most of the observers agree that the Corexit and also the VP1100X before this did a good job of getting the oil off the surface of the rocks.
But off the rocks was not enough. The committee used data based on three different comparisons of oil recovered and found that there was no significant difference in the amount recovered with Corexit compared to the amount recovered from the reference beach. There will continue to be discussions of Corexit, but use of the chemical has been halted. According to the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, Rear Admiral David Cangalini, if Exxon wishes to continue testing on a small scale, that will be considered. Otherwise, it cannot be used any longer while so many questions still remain.
Effectiveness, operational efficiency, there was questions concerning the plume, there was questions concerning the sediment, there was questions concerning, to some degree, but this was not a show-stopping thing, the toxicity. It was not a showstopper on the last one. Concern about deploying, the time required to deploy, and then the booms and equipment, and then to retrieve them. The amount of Corexit that was still in the water, Concern about the inconsistent, some of the data that didn't seem to be consistent. And it's just, I hate to use this phrase, but the water is still muddy on it. And so we need to have this clarified if we're to proceed further. We want to. I think all of us, I can't speak for the rest of the people, but we really had hope that this would work, but we just can't go on with the data that we have right now.
Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
When Port Lyons residents found out the incinerator was going to operate in Vicota Bay, they were angry, first because they had no opportunity to comment on the issue. At a public hearing held weeks ago, the only site under discussion was Kukak Bay on the Alaska Peninsula. Public opposition forced Exxon to come up with an alternative to Kukak, but Port Lyons residents say Vicota Bay is a poor alternative. It's only 3 miles from the village's watershed, and the prevailing winds in late summer and early fall blow from Vicota toward Port Lyons. Residents are worried about toxic fallout from the incinerator smoke. Tuesday night, Exxon officials attended a public meeting in Port Lyons to discuss the issue, but according to City Council member Timothy Ward, residents got angry when it appeared Exxon was not willing to discuss an alternative site.
They brought experts in. They brought a woman from Colorado who was supposedly an environmental health expert. They had some engineer from Exxon telling us how it worked. It was not any effort at all to accommodate us. It was just telling us that they were going to go ahead with the burn period. So that's where we decided to pull out all the stops and do what we have to get it stopped.
The Port Lyons City Council is holding a special meeting tonight to pass a resolution against the incinerator being placed in Vicota. They recommend it be placed off a Fognak Island in Molina Bay. The council hopes its action will convince DEC to revoke Exxon's permit.
Well, Exxon has a permit, but they don't have to use it. It's like a permit to drive a car. You don't have to go out and drive the car. And DEC can revoke this permit. They issued it. Our position is we just cannot have this in the vicinity here. There are a number of mothers here in town that are very gravely concerned about their children and the effects of this and this toxic fallout getting into our watershed and the surrounding area here. We just can't. There's not a compromising position for us other than to urge the Exxon company to move the operation up to Molina Bay now.
Molina Bay is far enough away from both Port Lyons and Yuzinki for residents to feel comfortable. Or, says Ward, if the incinerator is so safe, why not put it close to the city of Kodiak? Exxon plans to go ahead and start burning in 4 days. Pete Skwartzoff, acting mayor of Port Lyons, says if that happens, residents have informed Exxon they plan to set up a blockade in the bay.
I told Peavy that I was going to organize a bunch of boats and skiffs and go over there and surround the thing or something, and he said, go ahead.
Acting mayor of Port Lyons, Pete Skwartzoff. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Exxon still declines to comment on its winter plan. Spokesman Bill Rainey says Exxon isn't ready yet.
What we plan to review and very soon is what we plan to do during the winter, what we suggest that Exxon's role should be during the winter, and how we transition from where we are right now into that winter program. Not quite ready to do that. Should be ready very soon.
One clue of how soon is that Exxon is canceling its tours of beach cleaning efforts on August 31st, according to Exxon spokesman John Nichols.
Yes, at the end of August, we shall be getting ready to change over to our winter operations, and we shall need all of the available helicopters in order to implement that change.
Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Our positions, we just cannot have this in the vicinity here. There are a number of mothers here in town that are very gravely concerned about their children and the effects of this and this toxic fallout getting into our watershed and the surrounding area here. We just can't. There's not a compromising position for us other than to urge the Exxon company to move the operation up to Molina Bay now.
I told Peavy that I was going to organize a bunch of boats and skiffs and go over there and surround the thing or something. And he said, go ahead.
Exxon has a team of archaeologists identifying and trying to protect historic cultural sites and objects impacted by the oil spill. Many historic and prehistoric sites have been found. Most of the artifacts are still in place, but a few have been collected. Exxon has worked with native groups to assure confidentiality of locations, but a recent Exxon decision to provide a public presentation of how things are protected in the field, coupled with a showing of some of the artifacts collected, met with firm objection from the Cordova Village Corporation, EAC. Steve Renberg, CEO of the EAC Corporation, says alerting the public that artifacts exist will encourage looting.
You're going to have your amateur archaeologist who's going to destroy more things than they're going to, than they're going to collect, and the possibility of grave robbing going on.
The EAC Corporation says shareholders working on the cleanup effort have already reported seeing artifacts in the possession of other oil spill workers.
If they're taking it from native lands, it's wrong, and if they're taking it from state lands, it's against the law.
Exxon says it follows up on every report received by boarding vessels and staking out areas at night. And now Exxon is trying to obtain remote surveillance cameras. But even though there's proof of site disturbance, there's only one instance where removal of artifacts was proven. Reporting from Valdez, Alaska, I'm Sue Rapley.
Basically, what we are here for is to give a tongue to those who cannot speak, to the sea otter who have been choked and frozen to death, to the bald eagles, the hundreds of bald eagles and bald eagle eggs that have been killed by the oil, to the waterfowl, and
we got people working on it. We're not going to stop. He stopped us and said, no, I am not going to start it. There is a mechanical failure in the rotary kiln. So then he said, I said, thank you, you just made my day.
They're calling it a regatta. They want a large showing of boats offshore from the pipeline terminal on September 9th to show their dissatisfaction with the spill, the cleanup, and efforts to prevent future spills. Organizer Kelly Weaverling of Cordova District Fishermen United says 7 foreign flag supertankers regularly carry oil from the pipeline to the Virgin Islands. These are ultra-large crude carriers, bigger than the Exxon Valdez.
Ultra-large crude carriers, in fact, the ones that we're talking about, carry 50% more oil than the Exxon Valdez. And, in light of the cleanup and the claims cost, we want to know whether or not these supertanker owners are capable of being able to respond to a spill from their vessels.
Alyeska confirms that foreign flag tankers are used, but points out it's a very small portion of their traffic. Spokesperson Tom Brennan says they carry oil for the Amerada Hess Corporation around Cape Horn to refineries in the West Indies, thereby escaping the Jones Act requirement the U.S. bottoms be used for U.S. cargo. The refined products are then shipped into the U.S. for sale.
Now, I'm sure that the people are following the letter of the law, but being as this information is so little known, I would suspect that though they may be following the letter of the law, they may be smushing to smithereens the spirit of the law.
The fishermen's group is calling for Alyeska to take responsibility for the foreign flag tankers. Brennan says they already are responsible. They'd handle any containment and recovery the tanker owners couldn't and worry about the money later. Weaverling says Alyeska also ought to be responsible for preventing spills. He suggests a containerization process. He says the demonstration is intended to show that while oil companies may have a lot of money to spend influencing public opinion about spill issues, people can get their message across too.
There's been a lot of talk about Exxon's bucks dividing the people, and I certainly hope that that's not the case. I haven't seen it to be so here in Cordova, and I'd like that seen physically. And with a large event like this, it's my hope that it will be visually so interesting that it will get some national media attention and bring this little-known fact of foreign flag tankers into the public eye.
For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
The Nature article looks at what happened to several species of birds after an oil spill in Antarctica last January. As expected, many birds suffered. Numerous penguins died directly from being soaked with oil. The adults of another species apparently were so preoccupied by cleaning oil from their feathers that they failed to protect their young from predators. On the other hand, scavenger birds called petrels produced 30% more young this year, partly because they've feasted on penguin carcasses. But if spills give benefits at all, they are limited. That's the view of environmental and oil industry experts. Maitland Sharp, conservation director for the Isaac Walton League of America, says the Nature article misses the big picture about oil spills.
Practically any major insult to the environment ends up hurting many species, perhaps often benefiting some others. But the important point is that it ends up weakening the whole system by upsetting the balance. And that's the major point I think that the public should be focusing on with respect to the oil spill in Alaska and other such environmental disasters. And I just don't see that this particular piece of news adds a great deal to the debate.
Dory Smith, an ocean ecology expert with Greenpeace USA, agrees that benefits to some animals can't compare with the destruction inflicted by oil spills, especially those as big as the Exxon Valdez spill.
Clearly, pollution is degrading and in some cases causing the collapse of marine ecosystems from various sources, and the Exxon Valdez incident is a clear example of a disaster that has caused the demise of numerous species and the demise of some species that we can't even measure yet.
Smith says environmentalists are worried about the toll secondary effects of the oil spill will take on Alaskan wildlife. She says one example is the fate of Alaskan eagles, which are not adjusting to the Exxon Valdez spill the way petrels adapted to the Antarctica spill.
Many of the eggs didn't hatch this year because they were contaminated. Many of the birds, eagles died outright and couldn't raise young this year, and many of them abandoned their nests. So there's been tremendous indirect impact on predatory species and species that are suffering sublethal effects from contamination of their habitat.
Experts in the oil industry agree spills cause more problems than benefits for the environment, especially in the case of the Alaskan spill. June Siva, an oil spill expert with ARCO, says her concern goes beyond the spill to the environmental impact of some cleanup techniques.
In some cases, they've had to use some rather harsh techniques, like hot water. And if any organisms were still alive on those beaches, they certainly weren't after a harsh technique like that's used. So I think one of the things that'll be interesting to see are studies that are being done now following up the effects of cleanup. There's certain beaches that are going to be left uncleaned, and so we'll see what natural recovery does and then see how that compares with the various cleanup techniques that were used there.
Study of the Exxon Valdez incident will give a better picture of how extensively oil spills can damage the environment. But environmentalists are worried disputes over the initial cleanup have captured the attention of policymakers, and the needed research will come too late or not get done at all. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
This would reduce the exposure of the community to workers on an end of employment binge. It would encourage demobilized workers to return to Shreveport or Wasilla. For those who wanted to stay and work, that's one thing. For those who just want to kick out the jams, let them go home and do it.
Addressing the Valdez City Council, local resident Dave Hammack raised the issue of the social impacts that will accrue from the dismissal of thousands of oil spill workers, and he hearkened back to those first days.
I think early in the spill, the beverage dispensary facilities being open until 5 perhaps provided a place warm and dry for people who simply had no housing or no place to go to hang out until breakfast time or until the job service opened at 6 the next morning.
Hammack suggested that the council consider action on a temporary ordinance that would restrict bar hours to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, at least on weeknights, from as soon as possible to November 15th or even November 30th. Councilmember Sally McAdoo noted that a similar method is currently on trial in Seward.
I noticed that Seward is definitely doing this and has brought it forward. They've had a lot of public hearings on that, and so far it has not been that well accepted in Seward.
The initial suggestion was not altogether well accepted in Valdez either. Henry Irish, owner of the Glacier Bar, heard Hammack's proposal on the radio and hurried to the council chambers.
All you're going to have those same people that he's talking about. They're going to be walking around the streets looking for a place to break into. And by limiting hours, I don't think that's going to be solve your problem.
Irish insists that changes in bar hours have been tried in the past and should be left alone now, with owners allowed to regulate their own establishments.
This has been done in the past years. It's been repealed, and it's been opened up again, back and forth. And I think it ought to stay right where it is. And I think it's up to the businesses to take care of the problems themselves.
Exxon's general manager, Otto Harrison, says work crews are on rotating shifts and will probably be laid off as they cycle out for R&R. Harrison says some will move through Valdez, some through Seward, some through Whittier, some through Kodiak, and maybe some through Homer. But he says the objective for the cities involved is that people don't overnight. They go directly to a clearing site.
It's kind of an army discharge system. You come in, you know, you get your get cleared off the payroll, you get your final check, you get a medical if you need that. You get on a bus, and you go.
Harrison says the two clearing points will be Anchorage and Valdez. And demobilization is in progress. 252 people were removed from Exxon's totals yesterday. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The AET unit in Kodiak will take 7 to 10 days to repair. The Sealy unit is waiting for another permit. Both barges are flat-bottomed and weather-susceptible, so no matter when they finally get started, they're only expected to operate through the first week of September. But despite problems, Exxon's general manager Otto Harrison says by the end of October, all the oily waste will be gone.
Gone, gone. No liquid waste, no solid waste.
Exxon is continuing to ship oily solid waste to the North Slope Borough incinerator and the two shredders in Anchorage and Seward. Currently, almost 19,000 tons have been disposed of, and the huge mound of oily debris stockpiled at the Dayville roadside in Valdez has been reduced by half. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
I would like to physically demonstrate that we are solid, we have strength, and that we are unified. Exxon, you know, is quite a large corporation and was able to spend quite a lot of money and put a lot of people in the field to try and do something to mitigate the oil that they spilled. And we're wondering whether or not these foreign flag tankers can do that as well.
Face it, you know, they are running tankers through that sound all winter. If it's really so dangerous after September 15th that they can't mount or do a cleanup effort, what are they doing sending tankers through there? What happens if there was a spill on September 16th? I mean, there has to be an ability to continue to do some things, and I think the all or nothing approach that they've taken to date just is not realistic. Neither that case or any of the other cases that have been filed address the cleanup itself. And what we are trying to do is affect that process and affect it in the nearer term as opposed to the longer term. Certainly the litigation of all those other cases, I'm sure, will go on for years. And by that time, there may well be nothing further that can be done as far as cleanup operations. And our objective is to see that from this point forward, as much is done as possible to bring the sound back on as, you know, as expeditious an approach as can be done.
Exxon says in its plan, we'll come back in March and we'll sit down and we'll start talking about what can be done. Well, based on what we saw this summer, that'll mean that come, you know, by next June, Exxon will still be talking and thinking about what it could do or what it wants to do, even after the agencies have weighed in and given their opinions. So we want to make sure that the decision-making process occurs in as timely a fashion as practical, so that we don't have the kinds of delays that we saw this summer.
At the press briefing last Friday, Exxon's general manager Otto Harrison expected 3 weeks' use of the incinerator barges to get rid of the massive backlog of oily debris.
They will only operate probably through about the first week in September. They are flat-bottom barges. They will be weather-susceptible. So that's probably, you're only talking about maybe 3 weeks of operation out of those incinerators.
But it's been 5 days since then, and still neither incinerator is burning waste, or expects to be for a while yet. Just as crews were preparing to feed waste material into the rotary kiln incinerator at Kodiak, major damage was discovered. Exxon predicts it will take 7 to 10 days for replace and repair. Operations manager Bill Rainey says during the downtime, Exxon will continue to work with DEC to find an alternate site.
I'm hopeful that if it is concluded as an alternative site that's acceptable to all concerned, that a move could be accommodated without further delay in the incinerator startup. Obviously, we're very concerned that the mechanical problems have considerably delayed it from what we'd hoped for. And there are only so many days remaining when it can be used at all, so we'll want to take a look at that, too, and continue to dialogue with you on it.
At the Sealy Barge in Prince William Sound, the addition of auxiliary burners to allow a preheat to the required 1,700 degrees and the addition of water spray equipment to increase flue gas cooling meant that Exxon had to go through the permitting process again. Installation of the equipment was expected to be completed by today. But according to DEC's on-scene coordinator, Steve Provant, the permit is not ready yet.
I know Anchorage has received it, and they have to review it and possibly modify it to take into account the prevention of significant deterioration requirements, and that should take a maximum of 5 days to do.
Exxon's waste manager, Rob Dragnet, says the startup problems with waste incinerator barges are not unusual and should in no way indicate inferior design or equipment.
But these are big pieces of equipment, relatively complex. They're not assembly line units, much as an automobile might be. You wouldn't get into them, turn the key, and start up with them. You're going to normally expect to have some problems. We, of course, think it's unfortunate that our request for test burns earlier this summer were denied. We think that had we been allowed to proceed with the test burns, we would have uncovered these kind of problems earlier, would have allowed a much smoother repair, and had less impact on actual cleanup operations.
While waiting for these delays, Exxon is continuing to ship oily solid waste to the North Slopeboro incinerator and the two shredders in Anchorage and Seward. Currently, almost 19,000 tons have been disposed of, and the huge mound of oily debris stockpiled at the Dayville roadside in Valdez has been reduced by half. Exxon's Otto Harrison says by the end of October, it will all be gone.
Gone. At the end, when I said finish, I mean gone, okay? No liquid waste, no solid waste. We think we'll have that done at the end of October.
Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
At a meeting of the Interagency Shoreline Committee Monday, officials called the fluorescent orange markings offensive and set about to find the culprits responsible. It was Ken Middleton of the Department of Fish and Game who discovered the identity of the spray painters. As it turns out, those responsible for the damage are an official damage assessment team.
I think we have tracked it down. We're quite certain now that it's part of the damage assessment reconnaissance team establishing long-term baseline study stations. This involves a series of approximately 150 damage assessment study sites, Prince William Sound, Cook Inlet, Kodiak, Alaska Peninsula area.
The damage assessment team is part of a large-scale program under the Secretary of the Interior. This particular group is headed up by the Department of Fish and Game and includes representatives from the University of Alaska, the Forest Service, and the National Marine Fisheries Service. The team painted arrows, crosses, and slashes on various sites so the areas could be readily identified from the air.
As I understand it, these have been placed above the storm line as high as possible, and the purpose of those are for a ready aerial identification for the other agencies and other people that will be coming back to these exact same spots over the next 2 or 3 years to do additional long-term studies regarding damage assessment from the oil spill.
The Dayglow markings are semi-permanent and will be washed off when the studies are completed in about 2 years. Middleton says he's been unable to contact Fish and Game's damage assessment crew, but he's 98% sure they're the ones responsible for the markings.
It's almost certain. The problem is we can't talk. We have no ready way to talk to those people. They're out there in this vessel bouncing around in the water somewhere.
Ken Middleton of the Department of Fish and Game. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
When the Kenaitse tribe heard about their plight, they offered assistance the best way they knew how. They cast their 60-foot subsistence net and harvested more than 100 silver salmon. Claire Swan is the chairwoman of the Kenaitse.
We just told
them was we catch them, you fetch them. You know, the fish were packed in ice, and they were real fresh, and you know, just the whole the cleaning and cutting and everything is very satisfying.
Oh, we were happy to get them.
That's Vincent Kvasnikov, chief of English Bay. When the fish arrived, it took the village no time at all to start processing them.
Boy, I think they got busy same day. You know, I seen cutting there, you know. Seems like I see some smokehouses smoking now, and they must have put them away, and some are canning them, I think. That's what they're doing. We smoked all ours.
Vincent says that one of the legacies of this oil spill is that natives are no longer looking out for each other because they're getting too exposed to Western ways. But as far as Claire Swan is concerned, the native way of helping each other is still strong.
That's what traditional and customary fishing is, or the term subsistence is. It's part of it. It's what, you know, doing all the stuff you have to do to make sure somebody else gets it who can use it.
From Homer, Alaska, I'm Susan Kerner.
Face it, you know, they are running tankers through that sound all winter. If it's really so dangerous after September 15th that they can't mount or do a cleanup effort, what are they doing sending tankers through there? What happens if there was a spill on September 16th?
Exxon can only use Corexit with one trained work crew of about 25 people at one site on Smith Island. The operation will be closely monitored by experienced personnel, and decisions will be based on the observations of Coast Guard, EPA, and DEC. If the Exxon crew can satisfactorily prove that Corexit is a more efficient cleaner and the oil can be contained and recovered, the three monitors can allow Exxon to expand to a second team and then a third and fourth. If Exxon cannot demonstrate its ability to overcome operational problems, or if it's obvious there's no benefit to be gained from using Corexit, the Coast Guard, EPA, or DEC can halt the chemical treatment. Exxon says it will begin today. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
So from our standpoint, it is taking care of our assets. From a transportation standpoint, in a long run like this, the larger the unit, the more efficient and effective the transportation is.
What Exxon is saying to date is that we'll come back next spring, look at it, see where it is, and then think about what we're going to do. And what we say is that that's not good enough, that they need to start now, and there's no reason they can't start now, because we all know there's going to be weathered oil on the beaches next spring. They should be looking at options to deal with that now and not waiting till then and then being in a catch-up mode all next summer, too.
The bigger the unit, the more economical it is to haul oil. So on an incremental basis, the cost to carry a barrel of oil from Valdez to Panama, and they're on that run, is cheaper than, say, hauling it in a 50,000-ton vessel.
Under the damage assessment scheme laid out in federal law, state and federal trustees are charged with calculating the losses to the environment and wildlife from an oil spill or other disaster. Then any damages collected from the spiller are received by those trustees on behalf of the resources they have stewardship over. The state has been skeptical of the federal regulations on damage assessment for some time, but this latest controversy apparently boils down to a fight over who's laying claim to which resources. In a letter to Environmental Protection Agency Administrator William Riley this week, Governor Steve Cooper sought to reassert the state's primary trusteeship over most of the mammals, birds, fish, and plants harmed in the nation's worst oil spill. In an interview Thursday, Cooper said now that a potentially large court award is out there, it looks like the federal agencies are suddenly assuming trusteeship for resources the state has had control over since statehood.
Including all the resources that the state has traditionally had control over, like salmon, like deer, and bear, that sort of thing. And it's just greed, that's all it is. And we'll get it sorted out sooner or later, but we're just simply not going to give up jurisdiction over the traditional fish and game species that we've been managing for years and years. There wouldn't even be any salmon in Alaska if the state had not taken the steps that it did in the early 70s. And it's ridiculous for the Forest Service to come in and claim that they have jurisdiction over the salmon.
Cooper's recently been dealing with EPA because Riley received a directive from President Bush to restore the environment damaged by the spill. EPA is putting together a committee that EPA will chair. Riley offered the state the vice chair position. Cooper replied that that was not appropriate since the state must preserve its independence with regard to its resources. The governor believes this flap can be worked out, but he's not about to back down.
We're not going to give that up, and if the federal agencies insist on going ahead and claiming that they're the ones that ought to get the money for the damage to these resources, then we'll do what we have to do, including litigation if necessary.
Governor Steve Cooper. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
It's a rather complicated story of how we got to this after two refusals in the past 10 days. But according to NOAA's John Robinson, who chairs the Research and Development Committee, this is an attempt to see if Exxon can contain and recover the oil corrects it releases from the beach.
Our primary problem during the earlier Smith Island test was that we had two applications of corrective that didn't go very well in terms of, at least as viewed by the observers, in terms of the ability to contain the oil that was released from the beach, and then one that worked reasonably well. However, when you averaged all three together, we're not getting much improvement over the normal hot water washing method, and for that reason, the corrective application that Exxon had made for wide-scale use, wherever they chose, was denied.
But Robinson says by the last test, Exxon crews were beginning to control the oil better, so the decision was made to allow this very limited application. Exxon says it takes time to learn the right operational procedures, and with Corexit, it hasn't had much of a chance to try. Exxon has continued pushing for the chemical cleaner because they say with Corexit, shoreline treatment will go twice as fast for just as clean. The beaches in Prince William Sound vary so much in oil content and beach makeup that it can't be scientifically proven whether or not Corexit washes the beach cleaner than plain warm water. But Exxon's research manager, Hans John, says you can see the difference.
To the people that have seen a lot of warm water washing without chemical, it's just a drastic change, a drastic improvement. Immediately you see clean rock surfaces emerging, and as you'll put a quote in here from one of our beach masters, he said, well, it brings out the natural beauty of the rock. And you see the veins, and that's something you don't see with the standard warm water washing techniques, or very rarely.
So visual observations of cleaner, of efficiency, of containment, control, and recovery will be the basis of measuring how Corexit works, and the scope of work is very limited. Exxon can only use Corexit with one trained work crew of about 25 people at one site on Smith Island. The operation will be closely monitored by experienced personnel of the Coast Guard, EPA, and DEC. Decisions on whether to allow expansion to more crews and more sites or whether to shut down the operation altogether will be based on field observations by the Coast Guard, EPA, and DEC. Each of those retains full veto power, and according to DEC's on-scene coordinator, Steve Provant, the veto will be used if the benefits don't outweigh the risks.
We've felt all along that if they can demonstrate that there are some benefits to be gained by using Corexit over the negative aspects of it, which is that there is some toxicity to it. You know, it's not an extremely toxic material, but there is some toxicity to it, then you know, if there are some benefits that outweigh that risk of that toxicity, then we want to, you know, to allow them to use it. But we want to make sure that we're not letting the horse out of the barn.
State and federal agencies continue to approach Corexit cautiously because it's an unknown, while Exxon's technical manager, Bob Mastracchio, argues that everything has a risk to it.
It's a relative risk. You know, there's no absolutely, you can't say there is absolutely no risk to almost anything we're doing. You can't undo the oil spill. It's done. Now we're out there trying to get the oil off the shoreline, trying to mitigate to the best, you know, in the best possible way the impact of the oil spill, and there are different ways of doing it. One way is to walk away from it. I mean, that's a technique. Walk away, let Mother Nature take care of the oil. The other way is hot water washing. The other way is chemicals.
The decisions are hard ones. But in all fairness, says EPA's Doug Johnson, the problem is that the testing should have been done years ago.
Why are we having to do this? Why are these people having to make these types of decisions when there's no R&D going on? That's a good question. And I wish I knew the answer. I think there's something sad here. Why, you know, come on, guys, you know, we know you. We've been having ships going back and forth for a long time up here. You know, at some point, this will happen, and it did. Why are we looking for answers that we should already have?
Exxon says it will begin the limited use of Corexit immediately. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
In a letter sent Wednesday to DEC, Borough Mayor Jerome Selby says the agency overlooked three state regulations when it gave Exxon permission to burn. First, the borough never received written notice the incinerator would be placed in Vicoda. Selby says the borough should have been notified and consulted during the permit review. Secondly, the borough never had a chance to comment on the location. And finally, the letter says not enough consideration was given to the effects on coastal property or the residents in nearby Port Lyons. Selby says Vicoda is a poor site for the incinerator because of the bay's proximity to Port Lyons watershed and also because the area is heavily used by subsistence hunters. The borough is asking DEC to suspend the permit until a public hearing can be held on the issue. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.